Yes, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Sliding Windows podcast. I have another special guest today, Michael Niehaus. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Doing good.
Your name is so specific German. Do you have any German roots? I always wanted to say Guten Tag, Michael. What about this funny name? I always thought, is that an expat in the USA? Would you like to tell a little bit about your personal history?
From a family perspective, they immigrated from Germany to the Cincinnati area in the U.S. along with a whole lot of Germans in the mid-1800s. Yeah. So like, if you were to open a phone book, not that there are such things anymore in that area, you would see page after page of German names like mine. We ventured a little further into Indiana, so there's a fair number there. The community that I grew up in was like 99% German heritage. Yeah. So they still have Strassenfest festivals every summer. Yeah. And they've kind of embraced the German heritage. But unfortunately, my grandparents still spoke German. I speak almost none. So I've lost that, but that's true of a lot of immigrant backgrounds in the U.S.
Yes, of course. Somehow all people all around the world are migrants. It depends how long you go back to history. But the fun thing is that, especially in the United States, there is a distinct point in time, and some people know our ancestors have been on the Mayflower. And I think this is pretty interesting. So a lot of that information in Europe got lost during all the freaking wars. So it's a sad story.
Yeah. And for some reason, speaking German after the World Wars was not particularly popular, so it became less of a focus. But
yeah,
I wish I would have studied it more. I studied German 1 year in high school and didn't like the teacher.
Yes, of course.
So I didn't take any more, but oh well.
Yeah, it depends a lot on the teacher. If you like them, it's just another thing. Okay, but we have another language in common. And I don't speak about English. That is PowerShell. I took the chance to meet you and record this here in Sweden, Malmö, during the PowerShell conference. And the interesting thing is that I was very happy when I saw that you showed up on the schedule. But in my head, you're not directly connected to PowerShell. From my point of view, your personal experience goes way back, even before PowerShell existed. We had Visual Basic Script and all these things. And of course, since you've been a very, very visible and prominent member of the Microsoft mothership back in those days, of course, I want to ask you, what was your personal career over the decades? What did you do at Microsoft? And at one point in time, you quit Microsoft and you created a new, or you, you're employed by a new company. And I think it's pretty interesting to have an overview of that road that you passed by.
Yeah. I mean, I started out in IT. A lot of people start out in IT. Initially as a mainframe system programmer, which is a fun way to start writing assembly language code and keeping credit card systems up and running and that kind of stuff. But you kind of appreciate the value of a stable system running with thousands of users connected to it at all points in time. So when it came time to bring some kind of organization to the PC world, which was pretty new at that point, it was kind of natural for these ex-mainframe people to become the LAN administrators and the network engineers and the device management experts. There was no such thing at that point, but I went through that evolution and eventually started doing a lot of Windows work, really starting in the Windows 3.1.1, Windows 95 days, going around with stacks of floppies and upgrading PCs and basically saying, yeah, we should never do anything like this again. I'm sitting at PCs, feeding floppies in. So that has to be a better way.
The early 1990s or even earlier?
Early 1990s, yeah. And I started working with what was a new product for Microsoft at that point, Systems Management Server, in 95. The reasoning, the way I remember for the most part is I went to training for SMS.
Mm-hmm.
And the training was going on at a city about 2 hours from where I lived. My wife was pregnant with our oldest child.
Mm-hmm.
She's now...
Let's do the math.
She's going to turn 30 in December. So instead of the normal way of going to 2 hours of training, training 2 hours away, staying for the week and then coming back, I drove back and forth every day. But yeah, that's when it started. That eventually turned into like large scale Windows deployment work, which is how I ended up at Microsoft, brought in as a consultant to do basically to teach other customers how to deploy Windows at scale. That led into the Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, which at the time was still called BDD. BDD, the Business Desktop Deployment Solution Accelerator, was mostly guidance when I started. It was a lot of documentation that explained how you should deploy new versions of Windows. But when it came to the actual tools, it was a bunch of batch files.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few scripts hooked in and all kinds of different weird scripting languages. But there was no tooling per se. So
I remember I used that back in those days. I always remember VB script, but it could be everything, right? Because it consists of modules combined in a frame.
Yeah, before that, it was batch files and Kickstart scripts.
Yeah.
If you ever use Kickstart,
yes,
it's it's an interesting thing to work in. But yeah, we did shift pretty quickly away from Kickstart and more toward VB script and started building out more structure. And eventually it kind of circled back to what then became SMS 2003 before it became System Center Configuration Manager. That product, they decided they were going to add a task sequencing engine mm-hmm. to it. And we said, well, we're kind of building our own task sequencer for BDD. Can we share code between the two? We can look at SMS as the paid large-scale offering and BDD as the simple starting point for customers who want something quick and easy and free. So yeah, they agreed to do that. And at that point, we made the shift over to really align between those two products.
It was always said that this is actually a tool set created by Microsoft consultants going to companies, improving things a little bit, return to the company, combine that all, bundle that all. Is that a myth or is that definitely a ping pong between development and production?
For BDD and MDT, most definitely. I think everyone on the team was in Microsoft Consulting at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my case, I actually started working on it while I was still mm-hmm. a consultant. Basically consulting for Microsoft themselves. Eventually, they said, well, we're tired of paying the Microsoft consulting rates, mm-hmm. even internally. They were expensive. We would rather just move you to Redmond and give you a job.
Mm-hmm.
So it was cheaper for them to move me to Redmond and pay me full-time to work on that than it was to do the Microsoft consulting hourly rate to continue on like that.
And then you moved to Seattle area.
Moved to Seattle in 2005, 2006.
Yeah. You're still living there?
Still living there. Again. Yeah. Yeah. So that was, well, as we already mentioned, VB script was big at the time. That's what we were using for most stuff. But out of nowhere, I got a meeting notice after I had moved to Redmond saying, Jeffrey Snover would like to come talk to you. like, okay, I don't know who this guy is, but I haven't been in Redmond too long, and unsolicited meeting requests don't come my way very often. So yeah, sure, I'll sit down with someone for an hour and see what's going on. And it was the start of Monad. He was going basically door to door all around the Microsoft campus and encouraging teams to use PowerShell in a variety of ways. At that particular point, we weren't willing to do PowerShell on the client, but we were willing to do it on the server.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, well, yeah, it'd be really nice because we need to build a new UI and administrative interface, and probably use C Sharp and build it as an MMC snap-in, and it'll look like the typical Microsoft admin tools. But behind the scenes, we can leverage PowerShell. So everything in MDT that you would see as far as enumerating lists of operating systems and drivers and apps and all of that was all PowerShell driven.
Mm-hmm.
The typical user had no idea because it was all hidden in the code, but there was a whole set of PowerShell commandlets and drives and providers and all sorts of other things that made MDT work.
Yeah, and in terms of gathering information under the hood, it's obviously WMI again, so in some cases at least. I do remember, again, being an old fart, I do remember this time, and I tried to use, let me say it like this, I tried to use VBScript a lot. I was not a heavy user, because I always stumbled about this ludicrous language, which might be familiar to those people developing in comparable languages. But back in those days, there were no editor. We did the weirdest things. I remember that beyond Notepad, some people used the Office Suite and VBA because you could do some things a little bit better in the Office environment. And we didn't even have syntax highlighting and stuff like that. So right. It was really, really hard. And back in those days, old guys complaining about the past, you know, we're talking about the Stone Age, but there was no such thing as the internet as we have it today. And there was no artificial intelligence. I guess if I today would use VBScript, it would be very, very easy because I simply can say the agent, create this and that. And if you go through the code, you get it. But it's definitely not user-friendly. So my question is, assuming that you use this a lot, how did you do that? Did anyone ever said, we need a proper editor specialized for something like VBScript? Or did you have that internally?
Well, I mean, VBScript overall is super simple. As far as a language goes, it has the ability to do output, like you can write messages. It has ifs and thens and all the typical language stuff, but it can't write a file. It can't do much of anything without leveraging ActiveX controls or COM objects or whatever you want to call them these days. But that was the main challenge. It wasn't really the language. The language was simple. But we didn't spend much time worrying about editors, except for one thing, spaces versus tabs.
Yeah.
because some of us use Notepad, some of us use Visual Studio, and they wouldn't use the same indention mechanism. So another person would open up a script and it would just be all over the place. And it's like, oh, we had to agree. Are we going to do four spaces or are we going to do a tab? And eventually we decided on tabs and switched everyone over to using tabs because it saved like a megabyte in size.
Yeah.
No, four spaces versus one tab. That's four bytes versus one. We liked white space. So we could reduce the overall size of everything just by switching to tabs. But yeah, I don't think anyone really worried too much about the language syntax and anything like that because you always had to work around the language. The language was super simple.
When I recap on what you just said, it sounded to me just like SMS, later SCCM config manager, was actually built upon the foundation of your, of the team's work with BDT. Is that true? Or how much is that true? How much did it influence each other?
When the, like if you go back through the history, SMS 1.0, 1.1, 1.2, 2.0 didn't have OS deployment features at all. They decided to add that with, I think it was the SMS 2.0 OS deployment feature pack, typical Microsoft naming conventions, but it was an add-on to the SMS product that was built by the SMS team, which was in the same building as where we were, but using the expertise of the people that were on the Solution Accelerator team. So my boss, who was the person who brought me into Redmond eventually, was the person that they were working with to design that. So it was more of a collaboration between the Solution Accelerator team with their very strong consulting background and customer experience on how to do this in the real world, and the product team people that were down the hall saying, okay, we need to implement something. What they ended up doing in that OS deployment feature pack was very simple. Like they could deploy an OS, and to make it a little bit more flexible, they put in like exit points to say, you can put your own script here, your own script here, your own script there.
Task sequence.
But it wasn't a task sequence. It was just one script, one script, one script, and that's it. Yeah. So they spent a lot of time then taking the like the best practices that they had delivered and cramming it into these exit points and building out this big structure and eventually saying, you know, this is really awkward. It would be much better if we could just have individual steps and individual scripts that flow through the process. So
actually, this is why I just said, yes, that sounds like a task sequence, because that was the origin, the beginning, and it became later on.
Yeah, the task sequence didn't come until Configuration Manager, so it took a few more iterations to get that, to build that out, but that's that was the evolution that was going on at the time.
Maybe we should just explain for those who might never have worked with that. You could, and so maybe I'm wrong because they changed something. You can download MDT today.
You can.
Still. And you can install it, and then you get a nice graphical user interface. Actually, you don't really see, if you don't want to see, what's going on behind the scenes. And then you have all the little tasks, do this, do that, do that. For example, I want to activate the computer. I want to install or not install certain components. And this is what we call a sequence of things. And the single items are called tasks. And beyond that, beyond the scene, there is scripting somehow. And actually, until today, it could be everything. Today, there is a lot of PowerShell in it. That was then the next step. But we're just going back in time, how it all evolved. I think it's pretty interesting that it was, from your point of view, definitely we had that tool set first, and then it influenced the development of the big products that people buy for a lot of money. Because all the tools that we're just talking about, they were always free, right? You never charged for MDT or BDD or whatsoever, right?
Right. Yeah. All of the solution accelerators that were built, there were a number of them, but MDT was one of the bigger ones. All of them are free. And the even stranger piece is that the development team building it was in a marketing organization. So it was considered basically good business that we can give this stuff to customers to make it easier for them to adopt our products. So therefore, the marketing team invested the money. Eventually, they figured out that why do they have this engineering team inside of a marketing organization? Let's reorganize. And they shifted the whole team from Windows marketing, where it had been, over to the configuration manager team. So the two teams merged together. before that happened, I had actually moved into Windows marketing and was doing a product management role there. So I wasn't around when that reorg happened, but they picked up the whole team and said, okay, you're now part of the system center, the configuration manager, endpoint manager org.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, about a year after that, they laid them all off.
Okay.
Because what does a product team want to do? They want to make money. What are they not making from these people? Money. So everyone asked, well, did you know that that was coming?
Maybe.
No, I didn't know that was coming. But yeah, the rest of the team, a lot of them found different jobs inside of Microsoft. But the solution accelerator team itself was disbanded at that point and no longer exists. But
somehow I heard that before.
Yeah, the configuration manager team continued to support MDT, and they still do today.
Yeah.
But they haven't really put any work into it since 2019.
If we pass by these years that you just mentioned, we have to think about that is the old Bill Gates Microsoft. And there is that saying that great people hire great people, and that's the sole reason why Dave Cutler invented Windows NT or rewrote what he did before. Anyhow, lots of things seem to be a success by surprise. And the biggest surprise in our area seemed to be that at the time of the millennium, Microsoft became super successful, and they are until today, in an area that they didn't have any kind of focus on in the business, in the business environment. So if you think about deployment, today we take it for granted that we have thousands of boxes that we want to have in Windows in any flavor on it as a server, as a client. But back in those days, it was completely different. So the company itself didn't see any use case for massive deployments. And then we had Windows 2000. The success grew. And then virtualization showed up, VMware, etc. And now we had a massive amount of installation, and everything became bigger and bigger and bigger. Did you recognize that there is a change that Microsoft at one day recognized we need to do something because by accident, this is the same time frame that PowerShell started, just because they recognized we need to extend our toolchain?
I would say around that time, probably even a few years before PowerShell ever came about, there was a big focus on standard engineering practices, because you had all these different product teams and they were all doing their own thing, and they didn't have any consistency. So they started laying out these rules, like all products should have automation capabilities. They didn't necessarily specify what those automation capabilities were initially. They just said they needed automation capabilities. Eventually, then WMI came around and they said, well, WMI is a good example of something that you can use for automation. Then PowerShell came out and they said, well, PowerShell works as well. So every product that was releasing new versions had to follow those engineering guidelines, which now said you need to automate, and the two ways that were recommended were WMI and PowerShell. So pick one. Well, people that had already done WMI said, well, you can use PowerShell to talk to WMI, so we're covered. Whereas those that were just starting new would say, okay, well, we don't like WMI because it's a pain to write for, but hey, PowerShell, that's .NET based and C#, and we can be a whole lot more productive doing that. So we'll go that route instead. But I think a lot of the consistency that you see in between the products now really go back to those early 2000s years where they had that focus on common engineering practices. Otherwise, yeah, every product would have done their own thing and it would have been chaos.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And if we do a quick jump in time going forward to cloud environments, it is so obvious that we need another level, a higher level of automation. And again, history repeats that Microsoft, from my personal point of view, does not recognize this, because I think the tool set today is, may I say, rubbish. Of course, we are all cheering about a lot of good tools. But if you look at the task that should be done in the future, we're not good enough. I need a little bit more. We need more improvement in the PowerShell environment and so on and so on. And sometimes you don't think that really Microsoft gets the necessity to get all the products on the road.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say the one thing that was not anticipated was the shift to the web that would happen during all of that. So like, PowerShell made perfect sense to build commandlets that would talk to APIs that would do product things. But now you need to talk to web services, make REST calls, and go out to the cloud and talk to things like that. I don't think that was initially anticipated, but it works out reasonably well. But like I was complaining yesterday in one of my sessions, there's side effects. Like if you've got Graph as a good example in Azure with a huge number of basically endpoints that you can call to request things. So they want to make all that available via PowerShell. So they have commandlets to do that. Well, first they write the backend code and then they build Graph on top of that. The last thing they want to do is then build another layer on top of that to write PowerShell commandlets and that kind of stuff. So they built the ability to generate those via a tool. So you can just run a tool, point it at the REST APIs, and it generates PowerShell commandlets, which have names that are just gigantic because they follow the web APIs.
Yeah.
But they're easy. Just push a button and out comes PowerShell commandlets.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting twist on the whole situation, is they're not hand-tailored, they're not simplified to what I would call the average person's way of wanting to interact with the product, but they work. So I guess that checks the box that, yep, we provide a good automation layer through PowerShell, through these REST APIs, to the backend. That's just a little bit more convoluted than I think anyone would have foreseen 20 years ago.
I think that is a complete new discussion, right? We could go over that for hours. I think my personal view is it conflicts the basic PowerShell philosophy of simplicity. And you just mentioned it works. Yeah, it works without the commandlets. You can call the REST API with invoke REST method, invoke web request or curl or whatsoever.
Yeah.
So there is no necessity for rubbish commandlets. I think there is a necessity or a use case for good commandlets. And good commandlets, it defines on what is good. But from my point of view, the inner part, the core of PowerShell is simplicity, object orientation, and pipelining. If I personally name three things, then I would always need these things. And I don't see this. There is usually no pipelining support. It's definitely not simple. Yes, it's object orientation. Yes, I see. So anyhow, if you allow, I want to go back. I do like to talk about the old times. We had the millennium. We had Windows 2000. You were at Microsoft. You developed these things. They became even more important. And the next giant leap in mankind, from my perspective, was then the introduction of the WIM files, setting up Windows itself on a complete new ground. Ever since Windows Vista, where lots of things were developed that were great looking back, but we didn't like it back in those days. Ever since Windows Vista, we have basically an image that is distributed as a WIM file, and all the other things that come along with it, they were introduced in 2005, 2006, in that time frame. Have you been involved in that? How did you experience this new format? Because I assume it heavily influenced the tools that you created and used.
There were three pieces that I considered essential. One was Windows PE. Mm-hmm. You needed small version of Windows that you could run on a box without installing it. The second was the WIM file format, which was a non-destructive file-based imaging format, kind of like a zip file, but also capturing security and attributes and that kind of thing.
Did you ever meet the guys who created that?
Yes. And the third was USMT for migrating user state. Mm-hmm. USMT existed previously. It had been a single user tool. So like if you had a machine that five people used, you needed to run the tool five different times.
It is user state migration tool, USMT.
Yes. Yeah. So it would capture the user settings and then you could restore them onto another machine. So they created a new version of that, version 3, that was multi-user. It could enumerate all the users on the box and collect all the user data from each one of them, bundle it all up, take it to a new machine, recreate the users on a new machine, and lay the data back down again. So that was a good step. The WIM file format was actually in that OS deployment feature pack in 2003.
Yeah, it was a little bit before.
Yeah, little bit before I joined Microsoft. And Windows PE was slightly before I joined Microsoft as well. But interestingly, the same person worked on possibly all three, but at least two of them. Mm-hmm. The Windows PE and WIM file format were worked on by Wes Miller. Mm-hmm. He's now a Directions on Microsoft analyst. He's been around in the industry for a long time.
But pretty interesting. Yeah.
Those were his
babies.
Yeah, to get those out into the world. And without those, I don't know that any of this stuff really works that well.
I didn't know that WinPE is that old. I thought that it was developed to distribute the WIM file, but when I get it right, it was introduced a little bit earlier.
It had been around before, but it wasn't as componentized and easy to use. But with the OS deployment feature pack and the release that came out around then, it became much more modular, where you could say, okay, I've got my base. I want to add .NET to it. I want to add PowerShell to it. I want to add VBScript. I want to add a web browser. So all of those components were just building blocks that you could put into it.
Until today, you can see that this was the time where XML was pretty popular. Because until today, we have that auto-annotated XML or the annotated files that have been out there before, but in any format. How was that working with XML? Because this heavily is used in MDT today, right?
Yeah, we hated it.
Yeah, that's an honest word, right?
Yeah,
it's not really human readable, right? On first sight.
It's not super readable.
Yeah.
And the use of namespaces inside of XML should have never been done.
Okay, great.
You get strongly typed schemas and all that fun stuff. But at the same time, it adds way too much complexity to the overall setup. So like if you were to look at what MDT did with unattended XMLs, it did as little as possible. It treated them as text files and just did text substitution into the file rather than trying to use the full XML objects to interact with it, because it was just too nasty to do.
Yeah, from today's point of view, we have so many comparable but more simplistic things, just like YAML files or something like that.
That and JSON, yeah, they basically are pushbacks on the complexity of XML,
because they're good
way
enough.
Too hard. But at the same time, Windows made it worse, because the unattended file format it's kind of Windows self-describing itself into an XML file. Like, here are all the components. Here are all the settings on those components. Here are the phases of the Windows setup process and what settings apply in which phase.
And would you like to tell a little bit?
Just an awful UI on top of that complexity. But yeah, it's, I would think if they ever redid it, which I don't think they ever will, they would implement something much, much simpler than that.
Would you like to explain a little bit more about the seven stages of the Windows deployment?
I don't even remember what they all are.
You know, the fun thing is that you never use the seven, right? It depends on the way you do. When you do install from scratch, you have that first phase where simply WinPE boots. So just in case you need to interact, then you need to define the keyboard layout, but that must not be, or that is not, in some cases, it might not be the same keyboard layout that you use later on the box. So it adds an additional layer of complexity. And sometimes it's pretty confusing. It is 1, 4, 7, then you sysprep things, etc. But you manage that in the toolkit, so you don't actually need to know that if you have to use the toolkit.
Yeah, and I think over time we've done more and more to try to hide as much of that as possible, because no one wants to edit those unattend files. Old timers still do, but for most people, they just want an automated install of Windows. So give me a pre-configured template that does that. But I mean, the basic flow, you've got the Windows PE phase, which are really just settings for Windows PE, not the new OS. There's the specialized phase when Windows first boots up and says, okay, I'm on a new machine, I need to adjust myself. And then there is the out-of-box experience. So there's a machine UBI and user UBI phases where basically you want to automate the whole flow just to get it to the point where it can log in.
Yeah, that's the final step where you always say no, 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 no. But if you do it manually, or maybe you say yes.
You get tired
yes.
of just clicking next.
Yeah.
Go away, go away, go away, go away.
Before we go into the present time, I would like to add one more tool to the table. That is Windows Deployment Services. There has always been these parallelism in between the highly the expensive tools targeted towards business, and then you very often have some lightweight things that are free to go. And Windows Deployment Services, I guess introduced in Windows 2000, have been part of this server operating system. I liked it a lot. I liked it so much. I also did Linux installation stuff like that, because definitely possible and a nice way to install. I liked it because I understood most of it, or let's say 70%. If I look at Config Manager, I have to work for a couple of years with that product to really understand all the niche little things. I think if you look a little bit closer, it's not so super different, because most of the tools integrate each other. What's your point of view talking about Windows Deployment Services?
In WDS was the next generation of RIS. Did you ever use RIS?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that was nasty.
Yeah.
But that was going back to the unattend.txt days,
where
you did text installs of Windows, not the image-based mechanisms that we're used to today. So
RIS was remote installation services?
Remote installation services.
So for the listeners,
it could network boot a machine to kick off the winnt.exe/unattend and feed the unattend.txt file. So WDS came around because they realized that the OS gets bigger, and that building an OS file by file by laying it down on the disk just takes too long. So they moved to WIM files. So they needed a new version of RIS that could handle deploying WIM files and using Windows PE to do it, rather than that old text mode bootstrapper that was used before, which was more like DOS than it was Windows. So WDS came around for that. In fact, I think Wes was the same person who worked on that as well. But that had been around before I had joined Microsoft, and we were actually using WDS. And it basically had two features. One was to boot Windows PE, so network booting Pixie. And the second was to then pull down an operating system from the WDS server and put it down. So it was the super simple deployment toolkit effectively. MDT had more complexity to it because you had to build out the task sequences and add drivers and all that fun stuff. But with WDS, if you just wanted to lay down a simple OS, just import it in and push it out. So it became much more popular with mid-sized businesses. So it was...
And it was, compared to RIS, it was lightning fast because of that 32-bit kernel and all that old DOS style mode, right?
Yeah, and pulling an image is so much faster than pulling individual files across the network. So, yeah, it was much, much faster than things were previously. But it didn't typically provide enough functionality for enterprises. So enterprises started looking at the MDT and OS deployment feature pack and the other solutions that enabled you to customize things more. They still leveraged WDS to boot Windows PE over the network, but they didn't use it for anything beyond that.
Yeah, I see the main issue is that typically in a WDS environment, you go to any box and you click F7, F8, F12, whatever it is, and you boot it up and you do some manuals, check in to choose the image, etc. And beyond that, there is also no monitoring. You could use something else, or you could write some scripts, but there is no built-in monitoring functionality. And today you want to sit at your desk, push some buttons, get it started with remote boot, wake on LAN, whatsoever, and then see what's going on. And you don't want to go around distributing 100 machines or 1,000, et cetera. And this is where Config Manager comes into the place.
Right. Config Manager, MDT, to the point now where I guess telemetry is a good thing and a bad thing, but Microsoft looks at the telemetry and says, well, we're deploying 90% of our PCs using Config Manager and MDT. Therefore, let's just get rid of using WDS to do the same thing. So they, with Windows 11, they said, yeah, we'll still support WDS for Pixie booting Windows PE, but you want to install an OS? Well, use MDT or Config Manager to do that. No more WDS installing Windows 11 directly. I mean, you can script it up yourself. You can add a PowerShell script into a Windows PE image and import that into WDS and have it deliver it. But if you're going to go through that amount of effort, you might as well use MDT. So I think it became kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy of, it's not used heavily enough for Microsoft to even continue supporting it. So WDS is slowly fading.
Yeah. Yeah, there is another item that is slowly fading. And now, as I said before, we go forward in time, just approaching, not today, but things that are still valid today. Windows Update Service is one more thing that we need to mention. There were rumors always that this is a kind of crappy side project by some employee, and somehow they published it by accident and everyone started to use it. And the Windows Update Service, server, WSUS, is also fading away today. But there are only few tools that are more popular than WSUS. So what's your take on WSUS, the quality at all, and the future beyond WSUS?
Well, they announced last year that they would be discontinuing it. So it's in Windows Server 2025. It probably won't be in the next one. So that was basically what they announced, that let's call it Windows Server 2028 for lack of a better term. But if WSUS isn't in there, that basically means the clock is ticking, that Windows Server 2025 is only going to be around for 10 years. So within 10 years, you have to get off of it.
Yeah. The fun thing is that, from my point of view, the update problem has never been solved. There were some announcements where people think, oh, there is a new tool, and all of a sudden you recognize, okay, they introduced a new group policy setting. But anyhow, where do the updates come from? And Microsoft's take on this seems
just
to be,
get it
downloaded from the internet. But that is the last thing that my customers want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's going to be interesting. Obviously, there are a lot of customers who have air gap networks. They can't go out to the internet. There are a lot of customers who don't really want 400,000 PCs going out every patch Tuesday and downloading stuff. But there are ways to help, which actually ties in more to my new company and some of the work that they're doing. But it's okay for a lot of customers to go out to the internet, but it's not okay for every customer to do that. They want more controls. They have more restrictions.
Exactly. So
it's going to be interesting to see what Microsoft does in that space.
Yeah, it's so interesting to pass by these decades, 20 years, almost 30 years. And now you already mentioned it. You didn't retire, but you went on a new path. You left Microsoft and you have a new company. Please tell us about what they're doing. You just mentioned it.
Yeah.
And if you want to, you might be some insights about what motivated you to step off that train.
Yeah, I joined 2Pint Software about 2 years ago, just short of 2 years ago. And its focus historically has been on Pixie booting, which mm-hmm. goes back to the WDS mm-hmm. conversation, and also around peering of content, mm-hmm. which, like, if you're going to pull Windows updates mm-hmm. from the cloud, you want to make sure that you do it as little as possible. So can you make sure that one machine downloads it and then effectively shares it mm-hmm. with all the other PCs so that they're not all trying to go out to the internet at once and download that and flooding your WAN links or your internet connections? So they've built products to do that. iPixie Anywhere for the Pixie booting, which, if you've ever watched WDS boot in a network trace, you know why it sucks. It is pulling down the Windows WIM using mm-hmm. TFTP, which is not a good protocol. Mm-hmm. TFTP is UDP based. It's not TCP based. It's requires ACKs going back and forth very frequently. So it can be really slow. If you try to do it over a WAN link, no one would ever Pixie boot over a WAN link mm-hmm. using WDS. It's just excruciating.
Yeah, it's meant to be used for local network with low latency, and then it right. might make sense to have UDP, right?
Yeah, so there was an open source solution called iPixie created mm-hmm. a long time back, and it had the ability to download a really tiny file using TFTP. Doesn't matter what the performance is if you're only downloading a couple of megabytes. After that, it then switches and uses its own HTTP downloader. So it can then use web protocols, which are designed for slower networks and pulling the content down. 2Pint then got involved with that and said, okay, we're going to work with the iPixie team and take it one step further and add bits branch cache support so that we can do peering. So now you could have a WDS server that's
somewhere,
really a Windows PE server somewhere, holding that image, download it using HTTP, but before you get it from the server, look to see, are there any other peers nearby that have already downloaded this? And if there are, I'll just grab it from them instead. So it's super efficient to get it to the point where, like, a company with hundreds of thousands of machines might have one server mm-hmm. at a central location and they can boot PCs anywhere in the network. Mm-hmm. So that was where they started, taking iPixie, building up that functionality, taking it through the secure boot signing process for Microsoft so that it would run on UEFI-based PCs mm-hmm. and doing all that fun stuff. At the same time, then, they built up a second product called StifleR, which is about monitoring the peering efficiency of the network and controlling the peering process. Monitoring, it's not too bad. We can look at every download that's happening via bits or via delivery optimization and be able to tell you that this amount of data came from the server, this amount of data came from peers, so your peering efficiency is this. But it also will then say, we know how to make it better. Like, think of the Patch Tuesday scenario where you have a new update that comes out. What's going to happen? Well, let's say Tuesday morning, everyone comes into the office, they all start up their laptops, they sign in, and they all start checking for updates, and they all see, oh, hey, there's a new update, I better download it and install it. So you may have thousands of machines that suddenly say, I need this content, can I get it from peers? Nope, none of them seem to have it, I'll go out and download it from the internet. So you really don't want thousands of machines starting to download from the internet at once. So StifleR could see that happening and say, oh, all these things are trying to download the same file. Pause most of those. Let one of them finish so that it can start sharing the content with all the others. And then let everyone resume. And it increases the peering from zero to hopefully close to 100%. So that it's much more performant and friendly on the network.
So that is exactly your field of expertise?
So that was
a new challenge.
Their sphere of expertise at Two Pint, and I had started working with them when I was in Windows marketing, going back to the start of, really even before Windows 10. Think of what happened in Windows 10. With Windows 10, Microsoft said, we're going to release a new OS. Great. This new OS is going to be updated 3 times a year. Ooh. That's bad, because now you're telling customers that they're going to have to deploy a complete brand new operating system to every PC every 4 months. Now, it didn't actually work out that way. They slowed the pace down. They changed it to an annual release cycle, all that good stuff. But initially they said, we're going to push out this 4 gig OS that you need to deploy to every machine in your environment every 4 months. That's going to hurt. So we started working with Two Pint at that point to say, we need a solution to this problem. We need lots of solutions to this problem. Mm-hmm. So we started working with all sorts of vendors to say, what can you do to help with this content distribution problem? How do we get not only the operating system out to all these machines, but if you've ever watched what Windows does after it's been deployed, it downloads a whole bunch of other stuff. It downloads app updates and experience packs and all kinds of other things in the background. So you download a 4 gig image and it immediately downloads another 2, 3, 4, 5 gigabytes of stuff. Now it's even worse that it'll go out and download LLM models and put those on the machine. So there's another 5 gig worth of stuff that gets downloaded. So the content problem was huge. So that was when it started with Windows 10, the pace of change and the amount of internet downloads needed to keep Windows up to date was skyrocketing. So we needed solutions. So I've known those guys since even before that point. So it was just at the point where, like we were talking at dinner last night with a group of us saying that initially you start in IT and you pick a job that's working on the greatest technology. And then over time, you start to realize, I just want to work on a good team. And then after that, you realize, no, I also want to work for a good boss. So I've just been fortunate enough that after 30 years in the industry, I could say, I'm going to pick a team that I know, a boss that I've worked with before for many years, and technology that I enjoy working on. So it was a good fit. But at the same time, they also said, you know what? We really want to get more into the OS deployment space as well, because we need to be able to better integrate these peer-to-peer and iPixie solutions into an OS deployment solution of our own. So basically, we set out then to recreate MDT with a new product called DeployR that is very close to beta, which is causing plenty of sleepless nights, but we're getting really close. But its basic function is to replace MDT, since MDT now is not really being maintained by Microsoft. It doesn't support Windows 11, hasn't had an update since 2019. Its days are numbered. But We also have this new cloud modern world, cloud native world that Microsoft wants to push, which is fine. If you want to use Intune, Autopilot, that kind of stuff, great. But you still have to do OS deployment.
Yeah.
For most customers, that was Config Manager or MDT. If MDT goes out of support, you need a replacement. Config Manager, are you going to keep around an entire Config Manager infrastructure just to do OS deployment? Mm. If you're using Intune and Autopilot for everything else, for some customers, the answer is no. So they may look at alternative solutions there too. So that's kind of the space that we're in, trying to make networks more efficient, booting processes more efficient, peering more efficient, OS deployment more efficient, all of those areas.
Very interesting space. Being at Microsoft for quite a long time, and then stepping out to a new company, did you recognize that there a lot of things change? So to give a glimpse of what I'm focusing on, I always have the idea that there is a light shining on Microsoft, then there's you as a Microsoft employee come to conference, something, you will be seen. And it's so much harder to introduce a new company, or it mustn't even be a new company. They can be there for decades. And you have to introduce and you have to explain. Did you recognize that you never needed to explain anything being a Microsoft employee? And today, things are totally different, attracting to customers. What was your experience at all?
I mean, I kind of had experiences in two different ways. One is exactly how you described, that you're no longer walking around with a big Microsoft sign above your head that says that,
you left the mothership.
Yes, I'm not the source of all knowledge. I'm just another person at that point. Yeah, that part's fine. It's useful, like for me, to still continue to blog on Oof Hours, and to just show general industry expertise and share information and all that good stuff as a way of staying somewhat relevant in the broader community. But at the same time, it's such a different environment from inside of Microsoft. Like, if people would ask me, what did you do at Microsoft? I would have to think about it for a while. And then my first answer would be, I attend meetings and reply to emails.
Mm-hmm.
40 hours a week. Yeah. Basically, as a product manager working at Microsoft, that's all you do all day. Is you go to meetings, you reply to emails. Well, when do you get actual work done? Oh, that's the nighttime shift to catch up on everything you missed because you spent the entire day in meetings.
Even more sad, that is the actual work.
Yeah, it becomes the work, right? Even the email replies are done in the nighttime because you don't have time to do it during all the meetings. But you quickly realize then when you shift to a different org that the culture is completely different. It's not email obsessed. It's not meeting obsessed. And there aren't so many people that you even need to have that number of meetings. It's like you've realized, how did I ever get anything done before with all of that going on? Now it's just like out of an 8-hour day, 7 hours of it can be productive.
Right. So you found your focal point again.
Yes. And I initially had that inside of Microsoft because I joined in as a consultant and then basically a lower level developer. So you had a good portion of your day to yourself to do work. But as you stay around for years and get into more product management roles and more senior roles, you don't have time to do that anymore. So that's the pleasant part of the change is I'm not in meetings all the time. I'm not doing email all day long. I can be productive.
And you made it to the PowerShell conference.
Made it to the PowerShell conference.
Not for granted.
This is actually my fourth week in a row at conferences. I went to Experts Live in the Netherlands, flew home for 2 days, repacked, then came back to Oslo for Workplace Ninja, Edinburgh for Workplace Ninja, here for the PowerShell conference.
And I assume you enjoy being at all these places. It's a good way to travel, right?
Yeah.
And to combine work.
The good thing about working from home and being able to be productive for 8 hours a day, it's super productive. At the same time, it's super isolated.
Yeah.
So, it's nice to get out into the real world and talk to real people. And
It's great to have you here, no doubt.
Yeah.
I would like to finish with a final topic. And I already thank you a lot for your time. There's one thing missing. These modern apps, this is one thing that we should also mention. I've got a friend of mine in the guest, shout out to you, who's working heavily on that. And that is one more thing, you're the black sheep of the family. They introduced that stuff. That's a completely new topic. They introduced the store. And from my point of view, I don't want to be impolite, but it's just a messy story. Yeah, they screw this up. They screw that up. And you have that technology that you think that it's worth that it survives. You published a script on the PowerShell Gallery where you showed us how to update these modern apps. And the fun thing, that is the reason why I want to highlight this. The fun thing is if you look at the script and you blogged about it with the out of office hours, oof hours, as you say.
Right.
Very interesting. We will link that. Very interesting blog. You blogged about how you developed the script. And it is something like that. You see, why do I have to reverse engineer somehow the underlying APIs? Shouldn't that be something that should be, in a simple way, be managed out of the box? What's your take on the modern apps and the ecosystem surrounding it? Do you have anything on the wish list that Microsoft might put into the product that would ease your life to focus on the important things in your new company?
Yeah. The whole story behind modern apps is worthy of books, and I think people have written books on it already. I think Mr. Sanofsky has a book that goes through a lot of his history behind it. But the whole idea was initially, we need this UWP API and infrastructure to compete with iPad apps, that we can have a Windows equivalent to iPad apps. Except no one really wanted those apps. And they weren't like Win32 apps. They were like full screen, touch enabled tablet apps. So corporate developers, enterprise developers, ISVs who were developing for enterprises at that point looked at it like, why would I want that? Consumers weren't really that interested. They just, if they were using PCs and using Windows, they already knew Office and they used web browsers and they had other applications that they already had. There weren't many people creating new apps from scratch. So it was just an odd technology choice. And I think it was a complete failure overall, but it continues to evolve. And the evolution is more like backpedaling, like UWP is kind of became WinRT and WinUI, and now you can integrate them into your existing Win32 apps and use them without having to start over from scratch. So it's more about taking existing apps forward than it is about throwing it all away and starting from scratch. So I don't think anything magic is going to happen with that whole space. The one thing I would still like to see has nothing really to do with UWP, but has more to do with Windows. They're pre-installed in Windows. The inbox applications in Windows shouldn't be there. I mean, it's fine for, say, a notepad or a calculator or something like that. But for all the other stuff, just leave them out. They can be installed easily from the store if someone really wants them. But like for a typical enterprise, since we see statistics on downloads and peering for the two-pint work, typical enterprise, 90% of those apps are never launched on a machine.
Correct.
They're there. They sit there. They don't do anything. But they get updated at least once a week.
Exactly.
Because Microsoft continually releases fixes and new features. Like they'll throw
AI.
They'll put AI features into Notepad and Paint and those things. And if you never run them, well, it's still going to update it.
Yeah, but
so,
which is even worse. Some companies block all that things and try to block the updates, which is even worse. Then you have an outdated version on it, which can be a security problem.
Yeah, and before I left Microsoft, the proposal at the time was, well, if we can't get rid of the apps, can we at least make it so that they don't install until you launch them, so that they're just stubs?
Mm.
Like the first time you launch Paint, it installs it from the store.
Mm.
Because then you don't have to get months and years of updates if you never run Paint.
That's the PowerShell discussion, right? The best possibility to get PowerShell 7 on the box is simply to have an icon. And if you click on it, then you get PowerShell 7 because they will never distribute it.
Yeah, just automatically bootstrap it if it's not there. And you see other things like that in Windows. Like if you try to use WSL, it says, oh, hey, it's not the current version. I'll go fetch the current version and install it for
you. I think to wrap this up, the big elephant in the room is, why doesn't Microsoft never saw the necessity to have a repository, just like it's totally granted in any kind of Linux, where you can get the updates, the applications, where you can get all that stuff? And my personal vision always was, you have it, it's called the Microsoft Store, but you should stop advertising it for some rubbish games and start moving it forwards into a direction that people see, okay, that is our repository where we can get everything. We can also get these little games, okay, but you can also get Windows update, drivers, whatsoever. And there is a little bit of hope, not to be too enthusiastic, but there is one technology that bridges the gap a little bit. It's a little a glimpse of light, and that is WinGet, the app installer, which integrates the old world and the new world. And from what we know, the motivation seems to be to have a tool that allows Intune policies to do something meaningful with installation. And this is the direction that Microsoft is heavily looking for a good solution. So maybe it's getting better in the future.
Yeah, I think so. I think WinGet's finally realized that having one repository is not the answer, that having lots of disconnected repositories also isn't the answer. So you kind of need a meta repository engine, which is what WinGet becomes. It can talk to anything in the back end that just implements the standard repository protocols.
Versatile.
Great. PowerShell Gallery is another example of something that's been successful, but at the same time terrifies me because of how easy it is for someone to publish something to the PowerShell Gallery. Like I could publish a script to the PowerShell Gallery in 10 minutes and name it something like Microsoft Recovery Tool.ps1 and put whatever I want in there. Binaries, scripts, whatever malware I choose to put into it. If it's something that the virus scanners or Microsoft don't detect, now you just published malware that anyone can download and install.
Yeah, the sad story to add this to the discussion for the listeners. Yes, there are automatic checks, but there are automatic checks, and there is no necessity to sign anything in Windows, which is one of the biggest problems from my point of view. And if they had a strict signing policy, and that would imply not only signing itself, but also verification of the signer of the certificate, we could improve a little bit. But think about Windows itself. Not every binary in Windows is signed. Shipped by Microsoft. That is not allowed today, I think. They should definitely change
that. Yeah, if you find a binary that's not signed from Microsoft, that's a bug that they should fix. I thought they had fixed that many years ago, but there may still be some floating
around. Yeah, yeah, yeah. From my point of view,
they're not verified. Still. Like you could tweak a signed binary to the point where now it's no longer signed and it'll still run.
Okay, but we can look it up again. But anyhow, if you download something from the gallery and you have a module, an Azure module, for example, by Microsoft, they're also not signed. So just in case the built-in binaries are all signed, okay, that's one very good first step. But you have that ecosystem, and let's be honest, we know that from our phones, where we have that walled garden. Of course, we don't want to be locked in, but from a security point of view, this walled garden is the best thing that we ever had.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one thing covered in a session this week that I thought was a kind of an interesting development down that path for Microsoft. Mm-hmm. That, like, they publish content to the Windows Store and to the PowerShell Gallery and to GitHub and other places like that that people consume directly, but they're not technically fully Microsoft controlled and curated mm-hmm. spaces because anyone can submit things to them.
Yeah.
So they're creating their own now. They have the Microsoft artifact repository and things like that, where now the PS resource get and the various PowerShell components can now pull things from the authoritative master Microsoft source that Microsoft says, yes, you know for sure, anything that comes from this particular service is ours. So... I think that's the fear, is that a supply chain attack or a malware infestation that came through GitHub or came through the PowerShell gallery will make things look bad. Whereas if Microsoft starts pulling all of their stuff from those locations and only makes them available through this very secure, controlled artifact repository, then if you pulled it from somewhere else, it's your fault. You're starting to see all of those turnings happening as the realization that security needs to be job number one. As that takes hold, they're making adjustments.
And to maintain a stable product and to keep it safe, that's a lot of engineering work, right? And it slows down development. Of course it does. Yeah. Did we miss anything important? Anything that you wanted to mention?
Not that comes to mind. I think the blog we've mentioned will probably hit like 5 million views this summer. So it's still reasonably popular. I don't find as much time to do blogging as I used to, as I spend more time writing code these days. But I do still try to get blog posts out there when I get the chance.
Yeah, the fun thing, and this our talk delivers the same experience to me, at least. You deliver so much insights now that you're outside of Microsoft. But of course, you focus on these topics. And as long as Microsoft is the vendor, we constantly talk about Microsoft because we're in that ecosystem. Of course, and these insights that are so useful to understand, okay, where is the underlying problem? And here is the fix. So I do like your blog post and your blog posts, and I wish it had been there for 10 more years before that. But it's very good that you do it today. Michael, I wish you all the best for your new career. Let me say it like this, for that new path that you're on. It's very good to have you here. I think all people at the other conferences that you've been to and will be will enjoy your insights, and I do thank you, and maybe somewhere in the future we'll talk again and let's see what happened then in between. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.